All right, it is time for another edition of the Fifth Estate Podcast. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm your host. Neil Dewing is still away on his kind of month-long sabbatical, so it's just going to be me. As always, though, we're still going to say that we love when you go out on, when you subscribe to this podcast, when you leave a review for us on iTunes. We really appreciate that. It helps us out. It helps us reach a broader audience. And, you know, we like seeing the reviews. It's great. We kind of read them to, you know, our kids and everything to tell them how wonderful we are. That's what we do. So President-elect Donald Trump is kind of skipping the usual way of communicating with the public. He's stuck to his preferred method of communication, which is Twitter. And so a debate has come up recently about, you know, kind of how the press and how the media and how journalists should react and how they should cover Donald Trump's tweeting. And so I figured let's bring in somebody who has kind of commented on some of the stuff that Donald Trump has tweeted and kind of see what he thinks. So Charles Cook from National Review is here with us. Charles, thank you for being here. And, just to note for everybody that I told him this before we started, but Charles was the first guest that we had on the Fifth Estate, and now he's the first returning guest on the Fifth Estate. So all this money and prizes and everything we have for him at the end of the show, we'll get his address and send it to him for all that good stuff. So, but Charles, appreciate it. So a couple of weeks ago, I guess it was right after, it was about a couple days after Thanksgiving. Donald Trump, and it was funny, I don't know if you had seen where they realized that Trump was probably watching Fox and Friends or something, because they had done a segment on flag burning, and then he came out with this tweet where he said, "Nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be consequences, perhaps loss of citizenship or a year in jail." And of course, this kind of... this went, you know, kind of blew up, and people were responding to it, and from it came a couple of trains of thought as to how people should react to this. There were, I think there were about probably three groups. Four groups maybe. There were the freak out people, you know, the people who were, you know, going along saying this proves what kind of fascist, you know, dictator he is, and then there were. There was another group who were more measured to say, hey, you know, you're going to be president of the United States. You got to be careful about these kinds of things and what you're saying. And then there was another group that said, oh, well, you know, he's just trolling and he's putting that stuff out there. And then the media are just suckers for responding to it. And finally, you had the group that said, you know, ignore it. You know, this kind of thing shouldn't be even, you know, the media shouldn't even bother with it because it's, you know, unless it's official policy, then there's no reason to respond to it. What's your take on this? How do you see it?
Well, I think we need to separate out the two questions here. The first is, should Trump be tweeting in the way that he is? I think the answer is no. And should the press be freaking out in the way that it is? And I think the answer is no. What I've taken to calling the interregnum, the period between the election and Donald Trump taking office, has been filled with hysteria and silliness and extremely short attention spans. I'm not necessarily of the view that Donald Trump's tweeting is the product of some well-thought-through, dastardly plan to distract us from his shortcomings, but whether it's intended or not, the effect that it is having is to allow him every day to decide what we talk about, decide what the newspapers cover, decide what cable news covers. And that's no good thing in a moment in which the cabinet is being put together. Decisions are being made as to what Donald Trump will do with his wealth. And the Democratic Party is deciding what to do, having been largely swept away at every level. We should be talking about more than just those topics, sometimes serious, sometimes silly, that Donald Trump chooses each morning. On the question of flag burning, I'm vehemently against laws that would prohibit flag burning or punish flag burners. I think flag desecration prohibitions do indeed fall foul of the First Amendment. I'm with Justice Scalia on that question. I did think that the scale and tone of the criticism of Trump, though, was over the top. Now, the part of his, again, tweet that invited the most opprobrium was his suggestion that those who burn flags should have their citizenship stripped.
Right.
That's an appalling, appalling idea. It's an unconstitutional idea, clearly unconstitutional idea. It is not something that anybody in any position of power should ever be proposing. And were Donald Trump a thoughtful man, which he's not, I would have been deeply worried by that. The rest of it, though, the idea that one should be imprisoned for flag burning, or that the Supreme Court got the two seminal flag burning cases wrong, is not crazy. And it's not a sign that Donald Trump is out there on the ledge. Now, as I say, because I don't particularly care how many people are in favor of my liberty or not, that flag burning laws are popular is irrelevant to my position on this. I am vehemently against flag burning laws. I am as close to a First Amendment absolutist as you will get. But the way the press reacted indicated that they know nobody who disagrees.
Right.
And in fact, polling shows that a majority of Americans disagree with me and disagree with the New York Times and the Washington Post on this question. And Trump is tapping into that. And if you go back and look at the history, it's very interesting. In 1989, when the first Supreme Court case came down, 48 states out of 50, plus the federal government, had laws against flag burning. Those were swept away. And so strong was the sentiment against that decision that in 1989, Congress passed another flag burning law, which was then signed by President George H.W. Bush, which was then struck down in turn in 1990. And pretty much every year from 1996 to 2006, Congress tried to reintroduce either another law to ban flag burning or a constitutional amendment to overturn the two flag burning decisions. One of those bills was co-sponsored by Hillary Clinton in 2005, who was called out in the New York Times as a panderer for it. Now, again, the reason I bring this up is not to make it seem as if I personally have any reservations about this. I don't. But I don't think that you can oppose Donald Trump when he's wrong. And I don't think that you can oppose bad ideas within American culture unless you acknowledge first that there is often a large constituency for them. And in this case, there is a large constituency for them. Now, Donald Trump was elected by people who, by and large, believe that flag burning should be illegal. Of course, he's going to talk about it. I think that the press, and this is, of course, what you asked, and I've taken my usual circuitous route to the answer, but the press should have looked at that tweet and thought, well, he's articulating a popular position, a populist position, a position that is important to his voters. It's a position that has majority support in the United States. We might note that it's a bad idea or note the Supreme Court cases that serve as precedent here and then move on. But they didn't. They didn't. They spoke about it nonstop. They said, once again, this proves he's a fascist. Well, it no more proves he's a fascist than John Paul Stevens' dissent in both cases proves he's a fascist, and so on and so forth. So I am worried about Trump's tweeting. I'm worried about the reaction. I do think, though, that we've become far too quick to play the Hitler card.
Right. So I mean, yeah. So I think there's that. That's what I meant about the overreaction by some in the press who just went, you know, berserk over this tweet and started to, you know, freak out about it. I wonder what you think about this is that if there's something, you know, that is not official policy, should it be ignored? Is, you know, people are saying this should be ignored. And I said, well, this man is not just a candidate anymore. He's going to be the president of the United States in, you know, what now it's like 40 days or something or whatever it is. So it, you know, when he says something, does it demand breathless coverage for days upon days? No, because 9 times out of 10, he's usually moved on to something else anyway. And I think that's one of the things that people get trapped in, is that he is able to, because he tweets something one day, he tweets something completely outrageous or something the following day that makes everybody forget about what he said. I bet you couldn't even get people to name, could tell you exactly when he tweeted this flag burning tweet. They wouldn't know because of everything else he subsequently has said. But I think it's important to understand that just because he's tweeting it doesn't mean that it doesn't. I don't think we should. I don't think anybody in journalism, whether it's opinion journalism or it's reporting, should ignore it. I do believe, and I wonder what you think about that. I agree with you where it should be, okay, let's take a measured look at what he says and then kind of look around, because you're right. I think a lot of journalists don't realize they're still so disconnected from the Midwest and the people that voted for Donald Trump that they just automatically assume that everybody agrees with them. And you're right. They'd be wrong in that respect. So does it demand some kind of attention when he says something, or is it kind of something you blow off? Because I don't know if you can pick and choose.
I think Trump's tweeting does demand attention. He's about to be president, and sometimes he's indicating which policies he will pursue, which personnel he wishes to hire, and so forth. It's the scale of the reaction that I object to. I wouldn't want to see the press reflexively ignoring anything said by the president-elect. But it doesn't have to be that Donald Trump tweets something and that becomes the day's news. And it is also, as I said earlier, worth the press's time to work out whether they are outraged by a given statement, and indeed whether a statement is outrageous per se, or whether whether a statement is outrageous per se. I think there are many things that Americans believe outside of the coasts that are alien to media types, including myself. That doesn't make them wrong. There's an undercurrent of criticism of Trump that likes to paint him as being politically outré. And on a few issues he is, but generally speaking, for better or for worse, the man has his finger on the pulse. That's what populism is.
Right. I mean, I guess it was, I think it might have been, was it yesterday, when he tweeted about the cost of the F-35, which is, you know, it's kind of taboo for a Republican who would have complained about the cost of some kind of, you know, military piece of equipment. And so for him to say the costs are out of control, billions of dollars can and will be saved on military and other purchases after January 20th. So that's something. You know, it's funny, the media didn't really kind of go crazy on that one, because I think a lot of the people in the media would be happy to see, costs and military costs go down. But there were others, you know, if you're somebody who's working, at Lockheed Martin, you're probably, whoa, you know, what's this? So it's an incredible medium. What about, let me ask you this, because this has come up as well. We've kind of seen where, I don't know if you've seen it, where people are saying that, you know, we're at a point in history, especially with Donald Trump, where we should demand that the press be vigilant in their coverage of Donald Trump. And I, for one, am wondering, okay, well, where has that press coverage been for the last 8 years? Especially as it relates to Russia and the problems that, you know, we're seeing now. Everybody wants to look into the background of Rex Tillerson and go into his Russia connections, but this goes back to 2012 when Republicans have been warning, even probably prior to that. I mean, you know, for 8 years now, Republicans have been speaking up about Russia and saying, what is the administration doing? And it seems like the media didn't seem to care too much about it. Now, all of a sudden, it's an issue. So what about, how is that going to, how do you think, what do you kind of see going forward in terms of coverage of Trump as it relates to these similar issues that have afflicted the Obama administration. But it seems to me that they've kind of let him off the hook on a lot of this stuff.
Well, Obama is still president. And that's the variable here that seems to have been forgotten. On the first question, which was what about Trump's tweeting about Boeing and Lockheed Martin, I'm moderately pro-Trump on that question. I think he's entitled to his opinion. He's just been elected president. He has a clear interest in government contracts now, especially when they relate to the military and especially when they relate to the operation of the White House.
Right.
And I found it rather amusing to watch progressives who hate Lockheed Martin pretending they're worried about Lockheed Martin's shares. And frankly, yes, Trump has an unorthodox way of expressing himself, and he's using Twitter in a way nobody has before. But if Trump came into office and instructed the defense secretary to review the Lockheed Martin account, the market value of Lockheed Martin would fall in the same way. That's how procurement works.
Right.
So let's not pretend this is... you're not, but many are, that this is unique. On the question of Russia, there's so much fluffy thinking on this question. Essentially, the charge is that Russia tried to influence American voters during an American election on Barack Obama's watch. Now, that may be true. If it's true, I think two things have to be done. The first is we need an inquiry. It is not acceptable if foreign powers are hacking our major political parties, or in fact, if they're hacking our citizens who have no power at all. If that is the case, we need an inquiry and we need to up our cybersecurity. The second thing that needs to be done is an acknowledgement that Barack Obama is in charge of the agencies that oversee this and that he's still president. I see so many leaps of logic here. We start from the presumption that the Russians tried to or perhaps successfully influenced some people. And then we get to, therefore, Donald Trump shouldn't be chosen by the Electoral College, or therefore we need a do-over, or therefore the State Department should refuse to certify the election, which they don't do anyway. Why? If the charge were that the Russians had hacked the voting machines and that the totals that we're seeing are false, of course we would need to have another election. It would be unprecedented, but there would be very little option. But that's not what happened. Essentially, what we are acknowledging here is that the Russians managed to hand over information, possibly via WikiLeaks, to American news outlets that then reported it. Now, I hate the partisan back and forth, and I don't think two quoque arguments are helpful. But once again, President Obama is in charge of this. It was on his watch. And it wasn't as if it was on his watch, a watch that has been careful and resolute. It was on a watch that has been marked by mockery of those who have proposed that Russia is a threat, not least during the 2012 presidential debate, when he said the 1980s, of course, they want their foreign policy back. And the New York Times mocked Romney, and Think Progress mocked Romney, and the entire left-wing establishment, the entire pro-Obama media, I repeat myself, mocked Romney for it. And lo and behold, the Russians came in and did what they could to influence the election. So I think we need to be very, very clear here about what it is that we're talking about. Russia clearly tried to influence the U.S. election. And in some regards, they may have succeeded, at least in driving certain news stories. But then what? We can try and stop them. We can find out what happened. But not much more than that. And when the history books are written, the buck will have to stop with President Obama on whose watch this happened.
Right. I saw some complaints because I guess it was in October maybe or September, that the president had approached congressional leaders and say, hey, we want to have a show of support that we're, you know, against this, and you know, we're going to fight back against it. And I think McConnell told President Obama, no, we're not going to do that. And you know, so somehow or another, this, of course, the media is trying to blame Republicans for this, similarly to the way they blame Republicans for Obamacare being such a mess. You know, they, even though they didn't vote for it because they're not doing what Obama wants to fix it, that it's their fault that it's such a mess. It's really kind of stunning how they're able to kind of like turn the tables and make everything about the Republican Party and how they're the ones who are screwing things up. As far as the Russians, and I think this is, you know, some people floated this theory, and I kind of think of it as well. Maybe not so much influencing an outcome, but definitely causing a little bit of chaos within the election. I think that is certainly something that they did. I think that some people have said, and this is what I agree with, is that the Russians, like almost probably anybody else, probably thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. And, you know, by doing what they did would probably put her in a weakened position when she took office. The fact that Trump won is hilarious. I mean, again, it goes back to this whole thing we talked about where they were mocking Romney 4 years ago. They were mocking him, saying, you know, hey, you know, the Cold War is over and this kind of thing. And now all of a sudden they're saying that Donald Trump's president, you know, the Oval Office has been handed to him by Vladimir Putin. So it's just ridiculously hypocritical of that. But that's another matter, again, where the press seems to, like you said, Donald Trump is not the president yet. So why are they, you know, continuing to pour and pile on him as opposed to saying to President Obama, what are you prepared to do about this in the final days that you're in office? So again, it's a matter of media coverage. So one thing I want to kind of cover here too, as well with the media coverage, is, you know, how has this been any different? If do you recall, and then let me see what you think, the transition, or is it because we are in such a, you know, I think at the time in 2008, Twitter was still relatively new. People were still just getting used to it. There was no Snapchat. Facebook was still kind of, you know, there were still people using MySpace. How has social media, especially the idea that everybody is instantly connected to every piece of news that they could ever want, how has it changed elections going forward? Because this is the first year, I think the 2016 election, probably the first year that you had all these different types of technologies that have all kind of come together at the same time, you know, in one election. And how is that going to change? And what does it do in terms of, you know, overall media coverage and how they're going to handle it?
I think that Twitter and Facebook are not altogether good things for the Republic. The theory is that in an age of social media, in an age of easily accessible, quick internet, people will share ideas, form communities, learn. You see it in the TV adverts. We're all surfing the information superhighway together. People who have shared interests, who live a long way away, can form clubs as if they were neighbors. It doesn't quite work like that, though. It's become a tool for groupthink, for bullying, for the deliberate and unintentional spreading of misinformation, and it has created a news culture in which everything has to be breaking and new. I wrote recently about a trip to Florida I took, during which I watched a man on a balcony turn on a radio and listen to the news for 6 minutes in the morning and then go for a walk. And from what I could see, he wasn't checking his phone every 2 seconds.
Right.
He was doing what people did 30 years ago, which is controlling his access to media, taking it in nuggets. Now, I'm obviously grateful for the internet because it's brought me a career and a job and an income. I'm not sure I would have a job in quite the same way if it weren't for the internet. But I do think that in breaking down the gatekeepers, which has been one of the great things, because people who have really no contacts or no background in the media can now put their work out there and see it take flight, scale up, really without any financial outlay. Those people are benefiting immensely. But the downside is that there are no gatekeepers. There's no one we really trust. There's no Walter Cronkite it was also a bad thing because people thought whatever he said was the truth. And I wonder whether we're going to see more of a divided country, more partisanship, not along ideological lines, which is fine, but along factual lines. I mean, progressives like to pretend that conservatives believe a whole lot of nonsense, and there are indeed conservatives who believe a whole lot of nonsense. There's a whole industry out there dedicated to spreading lies about President Obama or Democrats or welfare or America. But it's equally true on the left. By 2006, half of all Democrats believe Bush had been involved in 9/11.
Right.
What do you think that's going to be like in 2019 with Donald Trump? I think it's going to get an awful lot worse. And I think that rather than liberating ourselves with technology, we are, in a sense, using it to self-segregate. And I'm not convinced that the left is well set up to deal with this because they have managed to take over the institutions. Conservatives might find it frustrating that there's so much misinformation out there, but they're also used to hearing misinformation from the media. They're used to hearing it from college professors. They're used to hearing it from teachers in schools. The left won. And when they won, they thought that they were forever in a position of strength to disseminate and choose information, but they're not now. So I think the combination of falsehood spread in the name of and about a president who is unusual in Trump, and the sadness that will be felt that the long march through the institutions has not yielded the absolute control they coveted. And they did. Look back at the Port Huron statement, for example. Is going to lead to a pretty interesting few years.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like you said, the left has won, particularly on college campuses, where there's enough misinformation being spread daily by college professors, like you said. So there's a lot of it there. There's also in the mainstream media, you know, we've heard all about this fake news. And in the meantime, there's been a number of mainstream outlets like the New York Times and Huffington Post who've been going out and repeating fake news. I think part of it, of course, is the financial aspect of it. You know, for some reason, people, my theory is in part, and you may agree or disagree, is that people are inclined to believe what reflects their point of view. So people want to believe that Barack Obama is not just a person with bad ideas who has an outlook for policy and laws that's different from you and I, but they actually believe that he has an evil intent, that his goal in somehow or another is to destroy the Republic as we know it. Now, his Obamacare is something that is, you know, lousy, but I don't think that he believed that he thought his signature legislation was a way to bring down the United States healthcare system. But people want to believe that. And so these sites that kind of cater to that are going to gain some kind of successful following. I guess the real issue is that they're able to profit from it. One of these gentlemen who was profiled, I think it was on CNN, actually voted for Hillary Clinton, but he ran a site that published news that was favorable to Donald Trump and was anti-Clinton and anti-Obama, and he made thousands and thousands of dollars a month as a result of that. So that's one of the issues I think that needs to be dealt with. The gatekeepers have to be the advertisers in some sense who are going to say, okay, we're going to look at what you're publishing and determine it. I don't know. I don't want the government getting involved. God, no. But you're right. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in 2 years from the moment that Donald Trump takes office until like the first midterm election. What is the news going to look like in terms of what things that he does and how many conspiracy theories they'll float while he's president? And so I guess one of the things it brings me back to is, you know, Trump, of course, do you think he's going to have access to Twitter when he's president?
I hope not, but my suspicion is that he will. I'm not sure there's anything that can be done about it. There's no law, as far as I know, outlawing a president from using social media. I think there are rules governing how the president accesses the internet.
Right. He's not going to be able to carry his Android around with him, I don't think.
Right. And I think there are rules governing email because emails are held to be government property. And so those extend to Twitter in that the president can't start deleting tweets.
Right.
But
so when he gets his misspelled tweets, he's going to have to leave them there.
Right. The one that goes viral will, of course, always have a spelling mistake in it.
Always.
But I don't think they can stop him, and I'd love to be the staffer who tries. It will take his wife or his closest friend advisor to tell him that it's hurting him. And I think that the problem is, Jay, is that at the moment it's not hurting him.
No, not at all.
It didn't hurt him during the campaign, and this is something I got wrong over and over and over again. I thought that he was hurting himself when he wasn't. At the best, some of his erratic behavior had neutral results. But in many cases, people liked it. They thought it demonstrated a certain authenticity.
Right. I guess the fear that I have, and I was discussing this with some people today, is, you know, when you're looking at the real extreme, you know, the joke about Kanye West running for president in 2020, even though that's a very, again, it's way out there, but, you know, this kind of quote unquote authenticity, which is really just, you know, it I don't know how much authenticity it is rather just somebody speaking differently as running for president, which is completely different from what we've normally heard. If you've seen in Ohio, Josh Mandel is going to be challenging Sherrod to his Senate seat, and Mandel has already started to use the language that Donald Trump used to win the presidency. And since, you know, Donald Trump won Ohio by a significant margin, Mandel is starting to use that. You know, we're seeing, you know, the kind of talk about the establishment and insiders and that kind of thing. And so I guess where I get nervous is, and I don't know if you feel the same way, is, you know, 4 years from now or 8 years from now, is there going to be somebody who's even kind of more outrageous? Or are they going to adopt the same tactics as Donald Trump? Or is he an anomaly, and we get back to kind of more of the, you know, what the campaigns we've been used to over the last 20, 30 years?
One of the interesting things about American politics is that, generally speaking, each president tends to be very different than the last. Each president tends to be a reaction against the last. And so in 1960, you see John Kennedy, the young Northeastern Obama of his day, I suppose, winning after Eisenhower, who was a crusty Midwestern general who had helped win World War II.
Right.
In 1976, you see Jimmy Carter elected in large part because he seemed honest. He seemed to be down home. He seemed to lack Nixon's venality. And although Gerald Ford was not a venal man, he was a Republican. He took over from Nixon. But then in 1980, you see President Reagan come in. And he's everything that Carter is not. That's not to say he's dishonest. But he is a very conservative Californian former movie star. And you see this in the modern day. I mean, Barack Obama is a reaction against George W. Bush. And George W. Bush was in part a reaction against Bill Clinton. And Donald Trump is a reaction against Barack Obama, for better or for worse. So I think the likelihood of Donald Trump being followed by somebody who is like Donald Trump is limited. But there is one caveat. The transition between Barack Obama and Donald Trump is not quite as unusual as one might think, in the sense that both are celebrity candidates who managed to leverage the culture, social media, the force of the cult to propel themselves to the presidency. So the big question now is, when we get to 2020 or perhaps 2024, it is without doubt that the candidate will be different in nature. But will that person have to be a celebrity? Or will that person have to play the same games? Or can we have, as after Woodrow Wilson, a return to normalcy? Will we go back to somebody who's more like Scott Walker, Calvin Coolidge, Harry Truman? And I don't know the answer to that. I hope we will, because as you know, one of my great objections in American politics is to the deification and celebritization of the White House. I loathe it. I don't like the way we've made the president the center of our political culture. I don't like the way we start every single debate as if what the president wants is what's important. The budget, for example, that's not how it works.
Right.
I don't like the idea that if Congress, which makes the law, says no to a law that the president wants, that it's somehow obstructing him. No, the president's making a suggestion and Congress, which makes the laws, is saying no. So I hope we will see a change. Do I think that this vulgar mien that Trump has perfected is going to be the future of American politics? No, I don't. I think this is a unique moment.
Well, that's a good sign, I hope. I hope as well. I think it is. All right, so we got a couple minutes. Let's since we're, both of us have been a couple of people who have been like spectacularly wrong on Donald Trump over the last 18 months, well, let's hear what you think might be a next year most presidents do something big in their first year or second year. What is going to be the signature legislative achievement that Donald Trump may put in place?
I think it may be pretty straightforward. I think he may do tax cuts, regulatory reform, repeal of Obamacare, and a Supreme Court justice. And at that point, if he does all that, that's it probably for his presidency.
I was thinking the same exact thing. I think his big legacy is going to be some kind of income tax. I am hoping that he can be convinced to sign on to a big income tax reform package, not necessarily just a reduction in rates and a reduction in the capital gains tax and the business tax, but, you know, some kind of elimination. It's time to, like, eliminate tax breaks for solar panels, that kind of thing. I think tax rates are kind of pointless when our tax code is created now in such a way that it almost brings it to a point where our tax rates mean nothing, because there's so many deductions that people can take and so many ways that they can reduce their tax liability that it doesn't matter. I think there's got to be some kind of reform on that, because if you go through, you know, and anybody who's done their own taxes, even if they do it on TurboTax, and they go through, if they were to go through every single section of things where they can deduct money, if they're itemizing their deductions, it could take them hours to do it. Even answering no to most of the questions. So I'm kind of hoping that there is some kind of reform, not just cuts, because I know we're already hearing the rumblings of people saying that how much money we're going to lose if we cut taxes, as if once again, you know, the money that people have belongs to the government, and, you know, now we're going to give some of it back to you, which I cannot stand. So the interesting thing is going to be the Supreme Court justice. You know, is he going to go with somebody who is in the mold of Scalia, or are we going to find another kind of Harriet Meyer situation going on?
I think that is the hill Senate Republicans will choose to die on. More so than Obamacare.
I hope so. I certainly hope so. All right, Charles. Thank you for taking the time out this week. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you're going to be celebrating your first birthday with your son, right? When was he born again?
He was born last March, so this will be the first Christmas first. We'll get that out of the way and
yes,
then start thinking about the birthday.
So the first Christmas, that's always fun. You know, your wife going to get the first Christmas ornament. You know, we did that, you know, with the kids and stuff like that. You always get the ornament that says, like, you know, year one, year two, that kind of thing. You guys into that or no?
Well, we have to take him all the way over to England for Christmas, so the scope for ornaments is limited, but maybe we'll buy him a first Christmas onesie.
So going all the way across the ocean for his first Christmas. That's cool.
That's right.
All right. Yeah. All right, a British Christmas. You guys going to watch Love Actually?
Probably not. We're probably going to watch It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay. All right.
But in England.
And if you are, okay, just so we know, we'll close out. I think this is going to be the last podcast of the year. So what we're going to do, we asked you on the first show, like, is Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin? I can't even remember what you said right now.
I said Frank Sinatra.
You said Frank Sinatra. Okay, so the next question that we asked is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Where are you on that one?
That's a great question. I think it probably is. I watched it over the weekend, or rather, I was working and my wife watched it.
Okay.
And I was half watching it.
Okay. All right. And
it
then,
is Christmas themed.
It is. There are people who say that that Christmas is incidental to the plot, but I say it's actually. I argue that it is critical to the plot because they simply could not carry out what they did on any other holiday. They just would not be able to have done it on Memorial Day. They needed everybody to be out of that building for the most part, everyone else around the building gone, the whole thing. They needed it almost clear. So,
well, and John McClane would probably not have been visiting Holly for Memorial Day.
No, who's going to? Yeah, exactly.
Maybe July 4th could have worked.
Maybe. But then only if it, you know, but if only if it fell
but
on
it
a weekend.
It wouldn't have been dark at the beginning of the film, which
right.
It needs to be.
And what kind of Japanese-owned company is going to be celebrating Independence Day with a party?
Well, true. Although there's actually a line in there where one of the characters says, I didn't know you guys celebrated
Christmas.
Yeah, that was
Bruce Willis. He said that to him. I didn't know you celebrated Christmas. I know.
Yeah.
All right, so the final question that we have.
That would be a microaggression today.
The final question we have before we go to our next one was, and this was franchise and everything. So we're not just talking about the TV show versus the movie. So we're the entire franchise. Are you Star Trek or Star Wars?
Oh, Star Wars.
All right. See, now when Neil comes back, he's going to be very disappointed because you like Frank Sinatra, you think Die Hard's a Christmas movie, and you like Star Wars. So he's lost out on all three of
this
those.
This will be my last appearance on your podcast.
He's going to fight. He'll fight you the next time we want to have you on. Be like, no, no, no. Or he'll make you answer the question beforehand to determine it. So, all right. Charles Cook from National Review, thank you so much. I hope you and your family have a very wonderful Christmas. Safe
thank
travels.
Thank you very much.
And
thank you.
Yeah, and we'll be certain to, you know, once we get into the Trump administration, we'll want to have you back on at some point and kind of discuss what had happened at that point.
Yeah, once we're out of the interregnum.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Okay, Charles Cook, everyone, thank you very much. Everybody, I think this is going to be the last podcast of the year because next week is going to be everybody's preparing for Christmas, and then it's going to be the New Year. But who knows? Maybe we'll do something. But either way, thank you for listening. As always, please go out there. Go ahead and subscribe to this podcast. Tell your friends about it. Leave us a review. We appreciate it. And we will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.